Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and today we're going to be talking with somebody I've been corresponding with for a while, and I'm very glad to finally get him on the phone. He's going to have some really interesting stories to tell us, not only about his own life, but about a great musician that we all know, and I'm really glad to be hearing his inside story on this musician versus all the other kind of stuff we've heard over the years. So without any further ado, let me introduce you to Art Frank, Art with two T's. Welcome, Art.
Hey, man. Nice to be here, Ken. Thanks for the introduction.
Hey, I'm really glad to have you on the phone, and I've been wanting to do this for a while, and everybody should know that Art's birthday is March 9th.
Right.
I won't forget. Now, Art, you've got quite a history in jazz, so if you don't mind, I always like to follow the same pattern. I like to find out when somebody first realized they were in love with music, and then when they first realized that they could actually be a jazz musician
as
a profession. So tell me, where are you from, and when did music first hit you?
Well, originally I was born in Westbrook, Maine. That's the hometown of Rudy Valley. And, my father worked in a paper mill called S.D. Warren. And I guess when I was born, my father said my left hand was really moving, and he thought I was going to be either a fighter or a drummer. And by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I was playing, you know, the old story, all the mailboxes around my hometown and my table, so on and so forth. And when I was 11 years old, I actually went into Portland, Maine, where my father used to frequent this nightclub with my mother called the Morocco Lounge. And I actually played with, I can't even think of his name. Can you believe that? He was a well-known, Sabby Lewis,
okay,
from Boston. He was a big name. And I played with him when I was 11 years old. And he said, man, I have a lot of talent. And I never owned a set of drums. And I got a position with the Westbrook Crusaders Drum and Bugle Corps in my hometown of Westbrook, Maine. And I was with them for a year. And then I left and went to hitchhiked down to Boston. I played with, I can't think of who they were, but anyway, I lasted for about a month. I came back to Maine. I was about 17. And I heard Charlie Parker one day on WJZ New York over my radio at night. And
okay,
I would listen to him every night. And I decided, man, I'm going to hitchhike down to New York to see if I could play with this guy. So, yeah, I was 16 and a half years old, so I hitchhiked down. And he was not the club they had advertised he would be yet. So anyway, I strolled around, and I came to this place called the Spotlight Lounge. And Stan Levy, whose birthday, as a matter of fact, is today, he would have been 92 years of age. And I walked into the club, and I waited to get down off the set, and I went over to him. I said, Stan Levy, I said, my name is Art Frank. I'm from Westbrook, Maine, and I would like to know if you could teach me something about bebop drumming. He could have told me to get lost or so on and so forth, but he was kind enough to take me aside to a table, sat me down, and he did something with his hands and asked me to do the same thing. Well, after the third time, I could do it. He told me to take that and just work with that beat. Other beats would come after it and develop. And it worked because I went back to Maine. I started playing on my own cable. And sure enough, 5 or 6 months later, I hitchhiked down to New York and went to the Royal Roost in New York City on Broadway. It was a chicken restaurant. And there was Charlie Parker, a young Miles Davis, Tad Dameron on piano. I think it was Curly Russell on bass and Max Brooks on drums. And when he came down, I was in what they call a bullpen for the younger kids, you know, who couldn't drink. As he came by, I said, Mr. Parker, I'll never forget what he said. He said, who's calling me Mr. Parker? So I said, I am, sir. He says, no one called me Mr. Parker. So anyway, he came over, and he was very nice to me, very warm. He said, how can I help you, kid? I said, well, I'd like to play and sit in with you. And he laughed. He says, what do you play? I said, drums, I think. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't own a set. So anyway, Max came over and nudged him, and he says, let the kid play a little bit. So anyway, he told me to hang around for about an hour, and I think it was maybe the second or third set. He called me up, and we did two tunes. I know the first one was called Cheryl's Blues, and I think the next one was called The Song Is You. And I played that, and he said to me, I was raw, but I had great placement and great time. And he told me to go in Woodshed. Well, listen, man, I went back to Maine, and we had one stove in the kitchen. It was a wood stove. And I started lugging armfuls of wood and piling it behind the stove. And my father came over and said, what the hell are you doing? I said, I'm wood shedding. Charlie Parker told me wood shedding. He says, that's not what he means. You know, I thought to get more wood for the stove. So, because don't forget, we were born in Maine. We only had one stove during the Depression, man, you know. So,
right.
Anyway, I started paying on a table again, and about 3 or 4 months later, or 6 months later, I went back to another club in New York where Charlie was playing, and he invited me up to sit in. And after I did 2 tunes, you know what he said?
What?
Now you're sweeping the store clean, man. Now you're sweeping the store clean. In other words, I had it. I had it.
Wow.
I had it.
That's amazing.
Charlie Parker himself.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, you can't get a higher authority on bebop.
Nope.
Let me ask you, your first trip down, when you went, was that your very first time ever to New York City?
Very first time in New York City, very first time. And
did
I was absolutely petrified.
I can imagine, because you were a country boy, right?
Yeah, and the city was so big and massive, and so many cars and buses, and it was loud. It was like an open heartbeat, man. Unbelievable. I was scared.
Wow.
And especially at nighttime, I had about $1.50 in my pocket. To me, that was a lot of money. And I went to this big restaurant on Broadway, and I walked in, and they said, you can't come in here, kid. I said, well, I want to see Mr. Parker. So they said, well, go stand in this little booth. And it was an area where people on the 18 would stand and watch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I took advantage of it, man. And another thing I might want to tell you, I have an enormous amount of faith in Almighty God and Yeshua, and I believe my prayers were answered, man, because I prayed and prayed and prayed, and they all came to pass, man.
I would say, and all that started with you hearing Charlie Parker on the radio.
That's right. That's right.
Unbelievable.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And
What were you thinking when you heard him play? What was it that grabbed you?
Oh, well, the melody, one thing, he was doing up-tempo stuff, but there was a pain and poignancy in his playing. My ears could hear, this guy's gone through some kind of stuff, because even though he was playing fast, Kenny was... There was a hint of pathos, of pain and poignancy in his playing. Like, and then when you hear him do ballad, oh my God, whoa! I said, I gotta meet this guy. And you know, when I did, there's a scene later in my movie, which I'll get to later when it comes out. I actually helped Charlie to hold on to his alto sax. He was going to sell it one night, but that's another story later on in years. But anyway, jump ahead to Chet Baker. Can I go there now?
Yeah, let's do that, for sure.
Okay, what happened was I was in the Korean War, I was in the United States Navy, I voluntarily enlisted, and thank God I did, because I'm getting free medicine today, you know. Anyway, I was coming back from Korea, and I heard on the Armed Forces radio this trumpet player, and I'm saying, who is this? He's playing a tune called The Lamp Is Low, you know, da 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 da. And then I could hear that same pathos, pain, and poignancy in his playing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he played a ballad, I think he was playing Imagination.
And okay.
I said, oh, my God, who was this? So anyway, I hung around until they said, that was Chet Baker, the next Army trumpeter by the name of Chet Baker. And boom, after I came home, it was in 1953, he had won the Downbeat and Metronome polls. So I read in the paper, in the Portland Press Herald, that Chet Baker would be appearing in December, I forget the exact date, at George Wein's Storyville in Boston.
Okay.
So I bought my kid brother's car, because I just got my license. I drove down to a winter storm, walked in, and who's there? Chet Baker. And there was somebody else broadcasting live over the radio. And I think I got a tape of that someplace. Anyway, I walked up to Chet after the first set, and he came back and said, hey, Chet. He says, yeah. I said, Art Frank, remember me? He looked at me and says, no, sorry, man. I felt about 3 inches high. And I came back to the bar, and the girl said, phony. I said, no. Anyway, so this is the fact now. Chet's going outside. He didn't smoke at that time. He's going outside with Russ Freeman. And also, I think it was Carson Smith on bass.
Okay.
So he turns around, and he looks at me. And he starts doing this with his fingers, like, come towards me. And he looked at me. I said, you talking to me? And he waves me on. So I said, gee. So I walked out. He says, come on up. Come outside. And I said, I go outside. We're standing on the street. He said, where were we supposed to have met, man? And I said, you know, I can't BS it, Chet. I never met you. I just heard you on the radio, and I had to meet you, man. He said, what do you do? I said, I play drums. I said, can I sit in? He says, well, not now, because everything's all set up. He said, but I'm playing in Birdland in a couple of weeks, opposite Miles Davis. If you come down here, you can be welcome to sit in. Well,
wow.
Make a long story short, I was working double shift at the mill when I was working at a paper mill in Westbrook, and I could not get anyone to sub for me, so I missed that opportunity of going down to play with Chet.
Wow.
And it would be 11 years later until I was moved out to L.A., that I ran into Chet at a place called Dante's in North Hollywood, and he couldn't play, Ken. He could not play. He had absolutely no chops. And I walked in, and I waited for him to walk by, and he looked so withdrawn. And I said, hey, Chet, Art Frank. He looked at me. I said, remember me? He says, no, can't say what to do, man. Yeah, you know. So I said, I was the guy standing with you on the street in Boston, and you were going by watching all the cars, and you said, if you hadn't have been a trumpet player, you would like to have been a race car driver at Le Mans and win a race. He said, are you that cat? I said, yeah. So he put his arms around me and hugged me. And we went down, sat down, and talked for a while, and I said, you going to be here tomorrow night? He says, no. He said, just hire me for one night to put some food on the table for my wife and kids, man. So I asked him, I said, listen, man, what are you doing tomorrow night? He says, nothing. I said, why don't you, Carol, and your kids come on down to have dinner with me and my wife and three kids? I gave him a telephone number. I never dreamed he'd call me. The next day he calls, and he said, I'll be coming down at 7:30. You know, Ken, I didn't have more than $12 or $13 in my pocket between me and my wife. I went to the store and I bought 2 pounds of hamburgers, potatoes, carrots, the whole bit, and a loaf of bread, and some ice cream and apple pie. And when Chet came down, it was just an answer to a prayer. I mean, come on, this is Chet Baker at my house,
right.
You know. And
right.
I got it on tape. I did a spoof tape of Chet and I listened to the show. I got it. It's part written in my book what I did. He was so gracious. But he was broke. He had lost his telephone. He had to call up from a neighbor's phone. But he was just full of pain, pathos, and poignancy. And he was a very gentle, very, very introspective, warm young man, you know. He was, I think he was about 37 or 38 then. And his wife, Carol, was a ravishing beauty from England. Beautiful. Three beautiful children, Dean, Paul, and Melissa. So, yeah, that's how it started.
Now, I don't know a lot of the details of his life. What had happened that left him in that situation at 37? Oh. No chops.
Yeah,
no
he
money.
Was working at a place in Sausalito, California, and as he was coming out, you know, he was on heroin at that time, I guess, and he was coming out, and these five, well, I'm not racist, but I mean, he said there were five black youth come at him, and wanted his money. And he told him, he said, he's not going to do it. He has to get the money to go home because he's a wife and kids. Well, they proceeded to beat the living hell out of him. And, I mean, they kicked him and broke his three upper front teeth. And he suffered permanent trigeminal nerve damage to both sides of his jaw. And the neurologist said Chet would never play again. He'd never, because he lost his armature. And make a long story short, he studied for... I bought him back his flugelhorn after about 5 months of us going together. And I said, I'll buy it back, Chet, with the promise that you'll practice. And he said he would. So over the course of another year, year and a half, I mean, he practiced, but not practiced. He practiced scales again. And it was painful. I mean, he would have to put the horn down. It was just so painful every time he'd blow, you know. Nothing would come out. So anyway... about 3 or 4 or 5 months down the line, he started to play. He could play a whole tune. And he was so pleased with himself. So he would take, when he'd go home in Redondo Beach, he'd take the horn and he'd go into a little linen closet with towels and face cloths in it. He'd put the horn inside of there and start playing. And that was where he developed that sound like a flute. That's just that soft, beautiful, magnificent sound that identifies Chet Baker other than any other trumpet player in the world. That's how he got it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, wow. And so, but now he had already had quite a career and had been famous.
Oh, he was top. He was at the very top, yeah.
Wow.
He won the International Critics Poll Award several times. He won the Downbeat Award, the Metronome Award. He was a, yeah, he, guy was hot as a firecracker. But wow. After that beating, see, after the beating, everyone, when I say this, and I mean this, nobody, no record dealer, no producer, no club owner, no musician would have anything to do with them. They all turned their backs on them. Wow. I was the only one, I repeat, I was the only one there after 1966 that took an interest in Chet. I was the only one. I got him his comeback gig at the Melody Room on the Sunset Strip in February 19, 1969. Leonard Feather was there. Dennis Cole was there. A lot of big people were there. Anyway, we did 4 or 5 nights there, and he started coming back. I mean, he was really, really, really playing. So I went to MGM and talked to Michael Kerb. Now, Jim Aubrey was the president of MGM Pictures. I knew him because I was painting his house. And he introduced me to Nicky Blair. And Nicky Blair introduced me to Mike Kerb. I talked to Mike Kerb about doing a CD for Chet Baker to make a comeback. And he said, you know what? I like your idea, Rod. He said, why don't we do this? Let's get Chet to do a CD. We'll call it Blood, Chet, and Tears. And we'll use the same music that Blood, Chet, and Tears, that Blood, Sweat, and Tears played. Only I said, well, I can do that, but I want Chet to be Chet. He said, oh, yeah. So I signed. He signed a contract with Chet at MGM Verve to do an album called Blood, Chet, and Tears. And I wrote the liner notes to it, and Chet was on his way after that. Never looked back. He became big, big, big. He went to New York, did Carnegie Hall with reunion with Jerry Mulligan, and was all the way up to the top again.
Wow. And he spent a fair amount of time in Europe, too.
Oh, yeah, he lived in Europe. I mean, God, he was a god over there. Yeah, he wanted me to go to Europe to do it several times, but I couldn't go because I had emphysema. And I really couldn't take a chance at my age, you know, my lungs would not inflate at that time, so I couldn't go. But we kept in constant touch, and my second book will reveal a lot of things about Chet that the people didn't know about. And the first one, you got to get a copy of it. It's called Chet Baker, The Missing Years. You can go on Amazon.com and check it out under the title Chet Baker, The Missing Years. It'll tell you something that you won't believe. I bring out the father of Chet, and he was the father of 3 children. Actually, 4 children. He was a humble husband. He was a nice son to his mother, Vera. I mean, these are the things that Chet didn't, and people don't know about Chet. They thought he was just a junkie. No, no, no. This guy was a beautiful, God-gifted human being, friend. Now, I want the truth to come out about him.
And that's in your book, Chet Baker, The Missing Years.
Yes, it is. Everything I'm telling you right now is in the book.
So this is really very important for people to hear, you know, because unfortunately the only image of him, one is an extremely talented, gifted, lyrical musician, and the other the other one is this guy with a drug problem, and that's kind of all people seem to know about him.
I know. Well, you know what the irony of it, we all have a problem of some sort. We have, like, I'm a medicine addict, because without medicine I wouldn't be able to breathe. I'm more oxygen. I'm some oxygen addict, but we all have addiction. But here's the kicker. But what they don't know about Chet was he's one of the most kindest human beings. My wife is in the next room, she can tell you. One time we're in New York City visiting him, and he said, Art, come on, let's go down to Vanguard. So he and I, my wife, Lisa, were walking down to the Vanguard. And along the way, there's a Mexican, Spanish, and a couple of black guys around a barrel fire. You know what a barrel fire is, right?
Okay. I know all about them.
Okay, so they're warming their hands, and it's a cold night, man. So Chet walks up to the guys, a Mexican guy, and he had just a T-shirt on, and he's freezing. So it's just, hey, man, takes his coat off. He says, try this on. Kid puts it on. He says, yeah, it feels good. Chet said, keep it. And he walked down. We went to the Vanguard. And the next day we were there, I walked into his bathroom. Walked in his bathroom. And there's a guy, a black guy, in there using the shower. I said, you know who that guy is? He says, no. I said, that's Chet Baker. He said, that's Chet Baker. I said, yeah. Chet would help the poor. One other story in Hollywood, after the gig at the Million Room, we're at a place called Ben Frank's on the Strip. It was Denny's place on the Strip. We're having a cup of coffee. This old guy, must have been around 60 in those days, he's bending down dumpster hunting in this open can. He's picks up some old chicken and he starts to eat it. Chet said, look at that cat, man. He said, I bet no one gives a S about this guy. He gets up, goes outside, takes the guy under the arm, and leaves him back in the restaurant, and buys him dinner and gives him a $20 bill. And Chet couldn't afford it. But he gave it to him. I'm not lying to you, man.
Wow.
Chet was a giving man. God rest his beautiful soul. He was a giving man. And I cry, literally cry, when I read the stuff about him, which is not true, man. Mm-hmm. He was a beautiful, beautiful, warm individual.
Well, I mean, you hear his music, and
thank you for saying that.
That tells you something about him. I mean,
thank you, Ken. You've got ears, baby. That's exactly right.
Wow. Wow.
That's exactly
right. Now you played with him quite a bit. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Oh, man. You know, the first time was in Hollywood after about a year of our hanging together and him practicing, coming back to the horn. I got him the gig, and I said, Chet, you can use any drum you want. He says, well, I want to use your art. I said, no, Chet, you don't owe me anything, man. He says, no. He says, I want you to play, man. I said, I love the way you play brushes, because I would play brushes behind my drums, you know, a snare drum I had in the kitchen. Man, he said, I love the way you play, man. So anyway, make a long story short, I opened up with him at the Melody Room. We had Frank Grazieri on piano, great piano player. And opening that night was David Dyson on bass. And then the next night we had the great Frank Della Rosa on bass. And Leonard Fedrick said the rhythm section consisted of three Franks: Art Frank on drums, Frank Della Rosa on bass, and Frank Strazzelli on piano. And Chet Baker. And we packed the place, man. And Herb Alpert came up. I mean, movie stars came up. Frank Yvonne, Dennis Cole, I think Dionne Warwick. A number of big people came. Unbelievable.
Well, and roughly what year would that have been?
That was February 2nd or 3rd or 9th in 1979.
Yeah, 69. So
yeah.
He was making his comeback.
Yes, he was. And right after that, I got him his first recording gig with Mike Curb at MGM Verve. And
wow.
After that, he was on his way. He went to Denver, Colorado. And to play with Phil Lurs, who was another great, great tenor saxophone player. And while they were there playing, Dizzy Gillespie came to town. And he said, Chet, he said, you're playing good, man. He says, I'd like to go to New York. He said, well, sure, man. So Dizzy picked up the phone, called the owner of the Half Note, got Chet 2 weeks at the Half Note in 1974. Chet was on his way. Now, anyway, to make a long story short, while Chet was gone, in 1971, February 9th, 1971, we had a major earthquake take place in California. And by that time, I was a good friend with Robert Conrad. We were going to do a movie in Tucson, Arizona, called Big Fall. So we went there, Burl Ives. Anyway, the movie never took place. Make a long story short, we moved back to Maine, and dig this. In 1975, I'm going to a jam session, and I hear on the radio a tune called She Was Too Good to Me. I said, that's Chet. He had just recorded a thing at the CTI All-Stars Festival, and he said, anyway, I called the radio station, and they said that was Chet Baker. So I wrote a letter to Chet. I thought it was still in California. It got to him in New York City, and he was living in Dobbs Ferry. So all of a sudden, one day, Saturday morning, the phone rings, and I said, hello. He says, it's me, man. I said, where are you? He said, I'm in Windham, Maine. Now, Windham, Maine was only about 3 miles from where I was.
Huh?
He had Carol and his three kids with him, and he wanted to know if he'd come to my house. I said, absolutely. We had a little place in the country. So anyway, he said he was having difficulty in Dobbs Ferry. His kid went to school one day and showed a picture of his father, who was a famous jazz musician, and the teacher said, oh, wow, you should be proud. Make a long story short, he goes back to that night, and they find out that Chet was a junkie, and everyone in the neighborhood started throwing tomatoes, rotten tomatoes, rotten apples, squash, corn, at his window, at his door. And I was there with me and my wife, and broke into his room, went through the window, and they were calling him all kinds of names and his wife all kinds of names. And get out of here. We don't want your kind here, baby. Get out of here. So the next morning, after we played the gig that night at St. James Firmament in Gorillas with Hud O'Brien, we went to the trailer and we moved all of his stuff, all of his, not furniture, but stuff. We came to Maine, and Chet lived with us and Carol and his kids for about three and a half, 4 months until he came back from Paris. Then we went down to New York to the CCI Jazz All-Star Festival in Wallman Rink in New York. You know, Hank Crawford, George Benson, Grover Washington, Ron Carter, et cetera, et cetera,
wow,
et cetera. And I'll tell you, the biggest thrill of my life, Ken, we're waiting backstage talking to Benny Goodman, who was a big fan of Chet, incidentally, as was my dear friend Dave Brubeck. Anyway, while waiting to go on, and the guy from France comes out, and you got to picture this in your mind. He comes out and he said, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, they said back, yeah, Quint." Now, I'd have given $50,000 just to be there in the audience. But I'm coming out as part of the Chet Baker Quintet. And I looked out, all I could see was a sea of kids. And that was the biggest thrill of my life, playing in front of all those people, man. That's the prayer come true.
Wow.
Yeah, biggest thrill of my life.
And CTI, that's Creed Taylor?
Creed Taylor, that's right. Creed Taylor. And the guy who was working from that time was named Peter Paul. I think he was the A&R man. And he had come down to Stryker's Pub where we were working with Harold Dank on piano, Cameron Brown on bass, and a great Bob Mover and alto sax, and myself and Chet. And he said, he came down and he handed Chet a piece of paper while we were playing. And Chet shook his head. And I said, what's that all about, Chet? He says, well, he said, that's Peter Paul, man. He wants me to do the CTI Jazz All-Star Festival tomorrow with the CTI musicians. So I said, are you going to do it? He said, I'm not going to do it, man. He comes back an hour and a half later, there's Peter Paul, and Chet said, the only way I'll do that is if I can use the quintet I've got here. Because he called me his all-time favorite drummer, Ken.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that. So how long were you playing with him? It was on and off at different times.
Yeah, off and on, I'd say from 1969 to 1988. We did a Buffalo thing. If you go on the YouTube, put Chet Baker, Art Frank, put it in that way. Put Art Frank first, then Chet Baker. Then you'll get all of it. If you put Chet first, you won't get that much of me. But if you put my name first with Chet Baker, you'll get a lot of stuff on YouTube about us.
Great, great. Have you guys playing together?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got some stuff here, Ken, that is archival. In Hollywood, I've got the comebacks, the tapes of the original comeback of Chet. I've got all of that stuff, and I haven't released it yet. And I've got other stuff of us playing in New York City and other places and other jazz clubs, which I can't release because, you know, difficulty, whatever, you know. I can't go into detail here, but, you know.
Yeah.
But hopefully one day it's going to be released.
That would be an interesting album to put all this comeback stuff on from the early years of the comeback.
Oh, I know. It's worth a fortune. But right now I just can't go into detail. I'll tell you privately sometime, you know.
Yeah, that's okay. Wow. Wow.
Now, he was the greatest man I've ever, greatest lyrical trumpet player and the greatest voice and the greatest scatting. He was just so real, so unpretentious, no attitude, nothing, no ego. He just lived to play, Ken.
Mm.
I mean,
you
what's
know, I heard
wrong
a story,
with that?
I heard a story about him when he was a baby. Apparently, when there was a radio show that at night, you know, they had the big band music on, and that he'd stand up in his crib and just hang on to the edge and just listen to the whole show very intently.
That's right. And then when he was about 6 or 7 years old, his mother Vera told me that he'd sit down in front of the radio and he'd emulate playing. And his father brought him, about 11 or 12 years old, his father brought him a big trombone and such that I couldn't play it because my hands were not that long. So Vera said, you know, his mom, why don't you bring Chetty a little trumpet, something smaller? So the next day, he comes in, he has a trumpet. He gives it to Chet. Chet sat down by the radio, and he listened to Harry James, and he could actually play, not the whole tune, but he could play things that Harry was doing, which was phenomenal for that age.
My God.
He was natural. He was an absolute God-gifted musician.
Wow. Wow.
Oh,
now, I understand that you do a lot of teaching now.
Yeah, I do. I just turned 84, and, you know, I've got fourth stage emphysema again, which is like, you know, it's hell. It's sometimes you can't breathe, and I can play, but I don't have the endurance that I used to. My ideas are there. I mean, I was just playing the other day for a couple of students. They said, man, it's like being back when I was 45 years ago. I mean, I can still play. Make no mistake about it. I can do up-tempo stuff, but I don't have the endurance anymore, Ken.
Sure, the wind, you know.
Right, I mean, exactly.
Drummers need wind, too.
Amen to that, yeah.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
But you're passing your art on to other younger musicians.
My daughter, Ken, her name is Kathy M. Frank. If you check on the internet, you'll see her picture on Facebook. I went to see her with my wife just the other night, and she's working with this great trumpet player by the name of Glenn Gross. I mean, this guy's a monster. And my son-in-law, Ken Berry on tennis sack, great, great player, she was absolutely smoking, and she made the same placement, the same roll, the same lateral, and the same throwing. But I was, and Lisa looked at me and said, my God, she's you. I mean, she's me. I mean, I'm telling you, she smokes.
Wow. That's Kathy M. Frank.
Yeah. And my son, Art Frank, the second, lives in Westlake Village in Los Angeles. He's an absolute monster drummer himself, but he tends to go to the other kind of music, like funk and stuff like that. But he's a fantastic drummer and a chess master, so. And my other daughter, Rhonda, is a marvelous jazz singer. She's got a voice like Chris Connors. And my former wife, Erla, who brought our children into the world, was Chet's favorite female vocalist. So there you go. And she's on YouTube under Erla Porch. And if you go on YouTube, you'll see Erla Porch. You'll hear her singing a couple of tunes. Great voice.
Could you tell me that name again? Did you say Irma?
No, E-A-R, like Earl. Erla,
E-A-R.
E-L-A. Erla Porch, P-O-R-C-H, Erla Porch Frank. But I think she goes under Erla Porch. And she's singing My Romance and I Thought About You. Anyway, if you go on YouTube and put down Erla Porch, you'll see her singing. She's a great singer. I mean, she's old enough. She's in her 80s, but she's a fantastic vocalist even now.
Wow.
You know, we've had our day, Ken, you know, but, you know, we look back, and every time I go into a club, you know, all our drummers come around me. They want pointers and stuff like that. I said, listen, man, I paid my dues. I don't want to sit in and play because, you know,
It's a lot of physical work.
People don't
think about, you know, fans may not think about that aspect of performing, but it's serious physical work.
It really is. I mean, you know, and sometimes you play with people who don't have the same intensity or the same urgency. Like in New York City, what I love about New York musicians, there's an urgency. We play with an edge. I mean, when I started with Charlie Parker, I mean, the tempos are up. I remember five or six to ten musicians, alto players, tenor players, going up on the stand to play with Bird.
Wow.
And everyone, as soon as they went up, would fire right back down because they couldn't hold the tempos. That's why Charlie Parker would not let or Chet Baker, for that matter, would not allow anyone to bring sheet music on the stand. Because if you haven't lived it, you can't play it. He said, I don't want anything that's written down on the stand. If you can't improvise, you're not wanted up here. That's why Bird would take tempo, so up tempo, so the guys who could not read would not be able to play it.
Gotcha. Wow.
So it makes a lot of sense. And that's why when I meet up with him, I said, man, I felt so good. I said, hey, I did a tune with Charlie Parker, and I didn't get bounced off the stand. I knew, baby, I was on my way then.
That's right. Not only did you not get bumped off, but the next time he complimented you.
Exactly. I also had him one night with Billie Holiday, too.
Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Well, I was my old friend Buck Clayton was a black trumpet player, sweet, wonderful man, and I was befriended with Buck. I remember I sat in with him someplace, one of the clubs in New York City, the Burnland, the Open Door, the Famous Tour, the Deuce, or whatever. Anyway, I came to see him one night, and I was with a friend of mine, and I can't think of his name. We walked into the club, and he spots me. He says, hey, Art, does he want to play a little? I said, who? He says, I want to back this singer. I said, He said, come on, man. You figured $35. I said, okay. So I go to get on the stand. The drums were there, and the sticks were there, and the cymbals. So the woman comes over and says, wait just a minute, like that, and says, yeah. She says, can you play Precious? I said, sure, I can. She says, let me see. Let me hear you play. So she takes me into the kitchen, all right? And she asks the cook or the chef to put down a great big pot, you know, a humongous pot. And to turn it upside down. He puts it on the table in the kitchen and turns it upside down. And she says, now let me hear you play. So I started playing stuff like that. And she says, this is what she said verbatim. You'll do just fine. You'll do just fine, honey. So I went out.
Wow.
And I played. I didn't know who she was. Here's the kicker. I didn't know who the hell she was.
Really?
I didn't know who she was. Billie Holiday, I'd heard it, but I didn't know who she was. I mean, I was young. I wasn't into backing a singer. I was playing. I wanted to play bop, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I took the $35 and was very happy. So anyway, about a week later, I was in a record store, I think in Connecticut, and there's this picture of Billie Holiday with a big, she had a flower in her hair.
Uh-huh.
I said, that's the chick. that's her. It was Billie Holiday.
I knew her
a week later, and I went to see her again. She was very gracious, and I think it was just before, about a month or two before she died. I think I saw her at a place called the Linux Lounge, I think, yeah. Such a sweet, dear soul. Such a sweet, dear soul. No one could sing like her. That woman, Ken, she lived the lyrics she was singing. She was not singing it. She absolutely lived the lyrics she was singing.
Wow.
And that's why she was so great. No one can emulate her. She lived the lyrics she was singing. Just like Charlie Parker said to me, man, if you ain't lived, you can't play it. And you think about that for a minute. I came up through the Depression years. I could not play. I had no lessons. I had no drums. I live what I play, man. Chet Baker was the same way. We didn't take it in. He lived what he played. That's the distinction. That's what it's called playing with a dude, when you live what you play. That's why when I sit down and play, and I've been told this, I'm not blowing my own horn, but they said when Art Frank sits down and play, he sparks the whole group. Yeah, because I'm playing my heart, man. I'm playing my history. I'm not playing from some rudiments. I'm playing my heart.
Well, that raises an issue here, a question. So
yeah.
You're an ear player. In other words, do you read?
No, I can't read a note. I can't. And yet I've written over 70 compositions. And what I do is I hum the melody into a tape recorder.
Uh-huh.
I send to my friend Graham Bruce out in California, who's a great trumpet player, or to Joe Cartwright, and they put the lyrics to it. I mean, they put the changes to it.
Wow.
I wrote well for Sharon Stone, and she's a good, close, personal friend of mine, the actress Sharon Stone.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So you go on my website, artfrank.com, you'll see a nice quote by her. Anyway, I wrote a jazz wall for her called Wall for Sharon Stone, and I went in, I got Rudy Berger from Vienna, Austria on violin. I got Rich Perry, fantastic tenor man from New York City, and I got the Nick Barrow. You got to hear it. It's Wall for Sharon Stone. You can get it on YouTube.
Okay.
And I wrote that. I can't read a note in music. I really can't. My wife is a trumpet player and a sculptor. She teaches me stuff, but I can't hang on to it. I can't read.
Well, you get to the music a different way.
Yeah. Well, you know, my dear close friend was Dave Brubeck. I mean, I wrote a song for him and his wife, Iola, and I wrote a couple of jazz waltzes. And he said, Art, one day, he says, Art, he called me on the phone. He says, my father-in-law blew his mind. He said, that's Dave Brubeck. I said, I know. He said, Art, I said, yes, Dave. He says, can you do me a favor? I said, sure. He says, I have a Connie request. I said, Dave, anything. He says, would you write me down a page of what Chet Baker thought of my playing? I wrote 8 pages. I couldn't get a healing.
Wow.
Yeah, I wrote, and it was in his archives. And he absolutely told me about Chet. When Chet was 16, he came to the Blackhawk and asked Dave if he could sit in. And he said, what tune do you want? He says, any tune. He said, well, Chet, he said, and Dave said, what key? He says, oh, any key, man. Just start and I'll fall in. And Dave could not get over the intensity and the talent of this guy to be improvisational as he was. Instead of Paul Desmondson used to steal come at Chet's licks to play. I mean, he was a phenomenon. But Dave Brubeck was one of the sweetest, most gentlest, God-loving men in the world. I'm telling you. I know some people in my day, and you know they're all gone now, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
They're all gone, man. They're all gone.
Wow. So, yeah. That's another amazing story. So there were other people you played with besides Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday. I'm curious about Bud Powell. Tell me how you came.
I played with his brother Richie too.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
Richie was a monster player too. You know, yeah, Bud, a great, great player. Tad Darren was a magnificent balladeer. Yeah. And you know, the guy today that was like Hod O'Brien. You ever hear Hod O'Brien?
No,
Hod O'Brien. H-O-D O'Brien. He just died. He was a great, great bebop player. I worked with him and Chet. So. And he was one of the closest to Bud Powell there was today. And then you got Harold Danko. You've heard of Harold Danko?
Sure.
Okay, Harold Danko is a great piano player. Then there's great Phil Markowitz. I just did a CD tribute. In fact, if you send me your address, I'll send you a couple of CDs of my tribute to Chet. I had Dave Lieben, the great Dave Lieben, on soprano sax. And the late Dennis Irwin on bass, and great Phil Michaels on piano, myself on drums. Yeah, and it did that. And I've worked with I've worked with so many people. If you look at my website, you'll see some people I've worked with. Sal Salvador, Al Cohen, Sonny Stitt. I've played with Sonny Stitt. I've played
Ted Kirsten, Jimmy Heath.
Jimmy Heath. Oh, yeah, I played with Jimmy Heath, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I played with a lot of guys.
You were inducted to the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame. Now, are you living in Oklahoma?
No, I live in just outside of Tucson, Arizona.
Okay.
Yeah, now, so what happened, I was inducted, which is a rarity because, you know, unless you're from the state or you've done something with the state, you don't get elected into it. But see, what happened was I was so close to Chet that they contacted me and they asked me if I would like to be inducted into the Jazz Hall of Fame. I mean, hey, Ken, to be inducted into the Hall of Fame is a big thing, especially for a guy who's got no background or no foundation. And Bob, yet there's the irony. I have no foundation, yet I play with everybody in Bob, okay? So anyway, I said, absolutely. So they paid my way down and back, and they asked me if I could knew anyone like Quincy Jones. I knew Quincy. Could I get him to be the Man of the Year Award, Lifetime Achievement Award for pianists? I said, no, he was busy, so I got the great Lalo Schifrin. You've heard of Lalo Schifrin? Mission Impossible fame. Cool Hand Luke. Yeah,
okay.
Anyway, he remembered me from Stephanie's in Beverly Hills, and he said, yeah, I'd like to do that art. So we met at Oklahoma. Lalo Schifrin was a Lifetime Achievement Award. I was inducted with the late, great Sam Rivers and other notable musicians. And I got up, and I sang Chet, sang just like Chet and scattered like Chet. And I gave a drum solo and, you know, brought the house down. And ironically, Stan Levy, the man I had met first when I was 16 in New York City, his son was there for my induction. His name is Bob Levy. And listen to this. Just recently, this past year, he moved out from Colorado to become my neighbor next door, right next, not even 20 feet from me.
Wow, that's a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's funny. And they have a Tucson Jazz Society out here, and I'm well known. You know, I never made money, man. But I'm known all over the world. I get emails from Brazil, from Buenos Aires, from Israel. It's just heartwarming. I mean, here I am, 84. And I'm still getting email and from fans all around the world. And they love Chet's music with mine. And it's a gift of God, Ken, you know?
It's incredible. It's incredible.
It really is. I mean, you think about it.
And people need to know, like, you're self-taught.
Yeah, I am. I never took a lesson in my life, ever. I don't even practice. You can ask my wife. I don't practice. I just walk in. Here's an old thing, Ken. What it means by being an air player and living it, if you can sing it, you can play it. If you've lived it, you can play it. You don't have to practice. I mean, if you practice, it ceases to be improvisational enough, doesn't it? Think about it for a minute. If you practice something until you get learned it con and root, then it's no longer improvisational. It's something you learn. You're bringing, like Bill Evans used to say. I knew Bill very well, too. And Bill said, well, if you practice something and you play it on the gig, it ceases to be improvisational, man. It's something you practice. And it makes sense. So I don't practice. Chet never practiced. We get down, we hit cold. That's what made it so spontaneous. It came from the heart, in the moment. In fact, I got a CD out called Art Frank in the Moment. Mm. After this, you send me a home address, and I'll send you a couple of CDs.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think people overlook that jazz, at the end of the day, is improvisation. And improvisation means getting up there creating something right on the spot.
That's it. That's what's called improvisation, right?
If
you practice it, it ceases to be improvisational.
Yeah, and so that sort of separates the I don't want to say that other people aren't serious, but it sort of separates the serious jazz people from just guys that are playing.
Well, you know what, here, I put in my book the great distinction. Everyone says Chet copied Miles. No, he did not. He liked the direction Miles was going in. He didn't copy him. His favorite trumpet was Freddie Webster. But see, when he heard Miles, he liked the direction he was going in. And he just went in that direction, okay? But here's the difference. Miles was a 30 school Juilliard school graduate.
Right.
Chet never studied in his life.
Amazing.
Think about that.
Amazing.
There you go.
And the book that you wrote that's available now, Chet Baker, The Missing Years.
Yeah.
Now you have another book that's coming out soon on Chet.
Well, what it is, again, is actually the same book, but it was so big that the publisher decided to make two books out of it because it was too big to put. So she put it the publisher called Chet Baker, The Missing Years, which deals with all the years that after he got the accident where he was not playing, was not visible, where everyone had turned their backs on him except me. It discusses that to his comeback and just a little bit beyond. Now the second book takes place when I'm back in Maine after the earthquake. And Chet comes back to live with me in 1975, and it goes on from there until the day he died and beyond. And
great.
It's very, very, very moving.
Oh, good. And that's coming out pretty soon.
It should be out. I should be getting a copy of it this week or next week before the final. She wants me to have the final read to see if everything's okay. If it is, I'll give my okay, and then the book will come out immediately.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, here's what Chet Baker said about Art Frank. Art Frank is my all-time favorite drummer. He always seems to know where I'm going. And
that makes you cry, you know, because
I know, right?
I paid the dues, you know.
And for people who want to follow Art, and I urge you to do that, if you love this music, you should. It's Art Frank with two T's, and that second T was a gift from Chet.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, we're sitting in a restaurant, Denny's in Hollywood, and Chet was down. You know, we couldn't get any gigs after the Melody Room, and he says, I got to make some money to support. Yeah. Wanted to support his wife and kids. I mean, contrary to what you read, Chet would always put his wife and kids first. Now, I'm telling you, I was there. Of course, he had problems, but you know what? The wife and kids came first. I don't care what you hear. I'm telling you, I was there. The wife and kids came first. Okay, we're sitting in Denny's, and he's worried about how he's going to make $100, $200 to pay the rent and take care of his wife and kids and put food on the table. I said to him, Chet, don't you think Art Pepper could help you? He says, he could, but I don't know, maybe he wouldn't. So anyway, as we're talking, he has this little telephone book, looks very small. How the hell he could read it, I don't know. But he opened, he says, I got three cats in here named Art. He says, there's Art, something, forgive me, I don't know his name, and Art Pepper and you. He says, every time I call the other Art, I get Art Pepper. Every time I call Art Pepper, I get you, or whatever. He says, I want to give you another T so I can tell you about my problems. I said, right. And he wrote it down and said, A-R-T-D Frank. And looked at that on paper and said, that's unique. So the next day, I'm telling you, I went down to someplace, I forget where it was, and I paid something like either $50 to $100 to have it legally, my pen name. So it became official. Yeah, he gave me the extra Hi Frank.
Okay.
Chet Baker.
Everybody listening to this definitely now understands if you're looking for Art Frank, it's ARTTFrank.com. And I completely recommend Art's first book, and we're all waiting anxiously for that second part of it to come out, which will come out soon. Art, thank you so much for the time and the memories and the insight. I really appreciate it.
And listen, you got my email, right? Send me your home address, and I'll send you some CDs.
Great. I'm going to do that. So this is Ken McCarthy. Been talking with Art Frank for Jazz on the Tube, and we'll catch you next time around.